Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Everyone, welcome to Dishing with Digest. I'm Stephanie Sloan, editorial director, here with Mara Levinsky, executive editor.
Hi, everyone.
Well, Mara, it's another sad week in the real-life soap universe. Andrea Evans, who appeared in multiple soaps, but most memorably, I would argue, as One Life to Live's Tina, passed away at the age of 66 after a battle with breast cancer. So, I mean, it definitely came as a shock, not only to us, I feel, but the soap community as a whole. I mean, she was just way too young. Andrea's mother had battled breast cancer as well, so she served as a celebrity ambassador for many years as City of Hope's Walk for Hope to Cure Breast Cancer. You know, remarkably, after she was diagnosed herself with it in 2011, Andrea completed chemotherapy while appearing simultaneously as Tawny on Bold and Beautiful and Tina on One Life to Live, which is just so impressive. I mean, I started at the magazine in 1990, you know, just around the time when Andrea retreated from the public eye because she was being stalked and was in danger. And, you know, that's in real life, mind you. So until she came back to daytime in 1999, most of my memories were of her in Landview. And it's just such a big loss. And I know you join me in sending condolences to her family and friends.
Oh, I absolutely do. You know, I think Andrea served up some of the most iconic moments in One Life to Live history, from going over the falls in Argentina to busting into Cord and Kate's wedding with a baby in her arms, claiming it was Cord's. In point of fact, it was actually little Al Holden, Max and Gabrielle's son. So as you just mentioned, you know, she was forced to step away from One Life in 1990 because she had a stalker, and a very dangerous one at that. And the stalker laws that were on the books at the time essentially made it such that the authorities could not intervene unless this man did actual physical harm to her. So she did live in a lot of fear. And she made the decision to leave the show after the actress Rebecca Schaefer, who she had known because Rebecca had done a few months of work on One Life to Live, was killed by her stalker. So I always admired Andrea for her bravery in the face of such a traumatic and frightening ordeal. And I was so glad that she had this second chapter of her soap career in the late 90s and early aughts as Tawny, and then her long run as Rebecca Hotchkiss on Passions. And of course, it was so fun to see her reprise Tina toward the end of One Life's run. It's a heartbreaking loss. And sadly, we also lost the actor Jeffrey Carlson, who all my children fans will remember for playing Zarf, the outrageous rocker who came out to Bianca as transgender and in 2007 began hormone therapy in order to live as her true self, Zoe. You know, Jeffrey was like just the perfect actor for that role and played Zoe so soulfully. And I think touched a lot of hearts with his work. He was only 48, and we send our thoughts and love to his loved ones as well.
Oh, absolutely. Now, I feel saying these words aloud is crazy, but Lorelei Bell is marking 40 years of playing Young and Restless as Christine. Now, I was in high school, as was she, when I started watching Y&R, and I said this back when the 50th anniversary special issue came out, but I was so drawn to Cricket's storyline. You know, she was a model and had cute boyfriends, and it just seemed like the perfect summer story for teens. And I know after you and I had her as a guest on this podcast, we spent a good chunk of time talking about how funny and cool and normal she was, yeah. You know, which really speaks to how she was raised by her parents, William J. Bell and Lee Philip Bell, who co-created both Y&R and Bold and Beautiful. You know, our colleague Devin Owens interviewed her for a feature in the new issue, and she looks back on her early years and the evolution of Cricket to Christine and just so much more. It's really a great read, and we wish Lorelei a very happy anniversary.
We sure do. And we also send Big happy anniversary energy out to Greg Rickert, who plays YNR's Kevin and Daze's Leo. He is marking the 20th anniversary of his Genoa City debut. So in the new issue, we toast to that milestone with an article featuring well wishes from the many, 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 many co-stars on both of those shows who clearly adore Greg. It put a real smile on my face to read through their accolades and messages for Greg. And that new issue that I just mentioned is also chock full of very juicy story preview of the week ahead, including what looks to be the final nail in the coffin of the Liam Hope marriage on B&B and the fun and exciting conclusion of Walt Willey's 3-episode arc on GH as his All My Children alter ego, Jackson Montgomery.
Well, speaking of Walt Willey, he is our guest today. So let's get him on the line and hear all about his daytime return. Hi, Walt.
Hello, hello.
How you doing?
I'm just swell. How are you?
We're great and could not be happier about speaking to you today.
You're very kind to have me on. Thank you.
Oh my gosh, such big news.
Yes. So,
and it's safe to say that you did not come from a showbiz family. But in addition to what we all know are your gifts as an on-camera artist and entertainer, you are an accomplished fine artist as well, and in fact majored in fine arts in college. So how old were you when you first discovered that you had that kind of gift and wasn't encouraged by your family?
I had great parents. My, you know, they waited 13 years to have me. So I was like, forget about it. I can do no wrong. And I was a genie and all this stuff. And so they were very supportive of the art. And it's really what I thought I would do. I always did. And then damn theater. Wove its spell on me and I walked away from it. But, you know, it's interesting. I don't consider myself a fine artist at all because I'm not trying to say anything. I would consider myself, and I'm not trying to be falsely modest here, but I would consider myself like a hack illustrator. I'm just learning the business. But I love to do it. I mean, I'm up at 5 a.m. I paint till about noon or so, and then I go for a walk and then have my first nap of many. That day. And it's what a great therapy.
Yeah. Okay. So the story goes that you moved to New York at the age of 30 to take a stab at an acting career there. But what were you doing in the years between graduating from college and deciding to make that big move to the big city?
Gosh, I got married very young. I got married for the first time at 20. And I did a variety of jobs. I sold men's clothes. I worked at a Radio Shack. I was a DJ in a discotheque. I did a bunch of stuff. The job I had before I moved to New York, I was selling men's clothes, and I got this customer. He was looking for like a tie and some socks, and I ended up selling like $800 worth of clothes, which was a lot in those days. And he said, you know, we've had a position open up where I work, and you might want to go out. You're a pretty good salesman. You might want to try. And so I got hired as director of sales administration for a manufacturing company that made gas grills and swing sets. And that's what I did for several years. And I knew nothing about it. Learned the business as I went along and, you know, went to all the shows, the houseware show and the hardware show and all this stuff, sporting goods shows. And I mean, it was, you know, nothing I had ever wanted to do or trained for or had any really inkling of. And then I got a call from a kid who had been a student in college when I had been, who was now, this is how many years had passed, who was now a tenured teacher at the university there. And he said, listen, this summer for summer company, we're doing The Passion of Dracula. We can't find anybody to play Dracula. Would you consider reading for them? I haven't done anything like that. You know, I'd done a few in college just as kind of a lark, and I hadn't done anything since. You know, would you read? Sure. Okay. So I ended up being cast as Dracula, and I did that show, and I did four the next year. And then the summer company afterwards, and I mean, the people in the theater department hated me. I was getting cast at all the leads, and they were like, really? Who is this guy? I feel bad about it. Still, you know, they give me that evil eye. And then I decided I was getting to be that age, and I thought, well, I don't want to turn 40 and wonder what if, you know, what if? That's such a horrible slippery slope to try to glide through. What if I had? And so I did. And, you know, probably the stupidest decision I ever made had it not turned out so well. But I had a great job. I'd just gotten like a 30% bonus. I mean, pay raise, because I found Sears was cheating us. And I was doing pretty well, but I just didn't want to turn 40 and wonder, you know, as I'm now the VP of sales at some manufacturing company and miserable if I could have. So decided to, you know.
Well, once you got to New York, how'd you go about breaking into the business?
just as bass-ackwards as you possibly could. I got a job, luckily, my first job. I lived in Queens. I lived in Elmhurst when I first got there. And my first job was with Golden Pen, or Golden LeBlanc, you might know them by. They sell theater tickets. They resell theater tickets in the booths in like the Hilton and in the, they're all the St. Regis. I worked both those hotels. So I got to see so many Broadway shows for free, you know. And so that was part of my continued training, was watching, you know, because I came out there to do theater, you know, of course. And I got the way I started into, I would rip things out of backstage and go on the auditions and, you know, maybe get a couple. I did a couple of showcases, and Betty Ray found me and liked me and started to work me, you know, cops and this and that, you know. And then I picked up a Ross report, pardon me, because I didn't know what I was doing, you know, really. And I started, oh, look at all that. Once I worked on Guiding Light, I thought, well, these soap operas, you know, here's a way to maybe make a little extra money. So I see Suzanne Ringrose, All My Children. And there's a phone number, 212-456. And I don't even see where it says, don't phone or come, in bold, all caps. I mean, I'm green as grass. I'm green. I didn't know what a headshot was, nothing. So I called her, and I guess when you have a name like Walt Willie, people hear Walter Mitty or Walt Disney, and it, you know, it sounds familiar, but not. So she said, yeah, come on in. I'd love to meet you. I said, great. I'll see you. Went in there. She gave me 2 days' work the following week. Let's see. I was Adam's jet pilot. I was Palmer's limo driver. I was the maitre d' at the Chateau. I was John the Yard Man on a remote. I can't remember what the story was. I put Greg in the back of the ambulance when he fell and broke his neck. I was a liveried servant in the remote where Jeremy's father fell off the horse and broke his neck and got killed. I'm sure I'm forgetting my two-thirds of them, you know.
I'm gonna throw one more in because I love it. You rented Chuck and Donna.
Their skis before they had that accident there. That's right. Yeah. And I was Swiss for that one. Yeah. Or wherever they were supposed to be. I was Swiss. Horrible. And I hope nobody ever finds it in the
the dredges of YouTube. So, I'm curious to know, when you were on set doing these small kinds of roles, who stood out to you among the actors as the kind of actor that acknowledged and maybe was even kind, maybe was even welcoming to the little people, the recurring players?
You know, Louis Edmonds, I roomed with him, you know, because there were not near enough dressing rooms and they were not near big enough. But everybody was doubled up. And I shared a dressing room with him a few times. And he was, when I read for something that I'm trying to remember, it was one of the, maybe Jeff Martin, I read for that and was called back for a screen test. And I remember sitting out there waiting, and here came Louis running on, said, oh dear boy, we all hope you make it. We'd love to have you here. You know, and it was just so nice. But everybody was welcoming. And I got to say that, so I don't forget to later, that was true when I went to General Hospital. I have never felt more welcomed. I've never felt more taken care of, looked after. And people seemed to be, you know, genuinely excited that I was there, which is, you know, when you just got out of the mothballs after 12 years, was not a bad way to feel, you know. And so it was really, and that's the way I always felt at Children. Children was always my home court. I mean, I worked Another World in Ryan's Hope and Guiding Light and As the World Turns and even Search for Tomorrow. But All My Children was always my my home court. Plus, I was the manager of the Ginger Man restaurant, which was right on 64th and Broadway, if I recall. And so ABC headquarters was like two blocks away, and all my children were like a block and a half away, and One Life to Live around the corner. So I got to see a lot of these people a lot of the time. So it was nice.
That's cool. That's awesome. Well, Adam and Palmer were, of course, two of the show's greatest rivals and individually wonderful characters. Now, sadly, both of their portrayers are no longer with us. But what comes to mind when you think about David Canary, who played Adam and Stewart, and James Mitchell, who played Palmer?
One of my first days on the show, my scenes were with Adam. And I don't even recall why, but they were. And I had been around and I'd seen him, and I was always quite impressed with him, his presence. And he was so literally rooted to the place. And, you couldn't have moved him if you wanted to. And he was intense. And then he turned around and do Stewart. And you were like, oh, you're the sweetest guy in the world. You know, and so that to me was just, that was a masterclass right there, to watch the Adam Stewart thing. But I remember ding dong, and I'm standing on one side of the door, he opens the door, and all I could hear was dun da dun da dun da dun da dun da dun da, because we watch that every Sunday in our house, you know, him in that little black hat with his coal black hair. And but James Mitchell was to work with James Mitchell and Eileen Hurley and Ruth Warwick and Louis Edmonds, and these people who were, Ruth Warwick was Hollywood royalty. She was Mrs. Citizen Kane, for God's sake, you know. And I just think that those were the people that intrigued me, and those were the people that I watched, you know. I watched the younger people too, Michael Knight was tearing it up at that point, so I definitely watched him. He was tearing it up, so... but that's where I learned the three camera setup. That's where I learned it, you know, was being paid to eat hamburgers or to serve them occasionally.
All right. Well, in 1986, as you noted, you were tapped by Another World to play the role of Cecile de Polignac's henchman, Jim LaRusso, where you got to work with Nancy Frangione, who played Cecile, and Stephen Schnetzer, who played Cass, and Ving Rhames, who, yes. And am I remembering correctly that you got to go on, like, it wasn't a long gig, but you got to go to the Virgin Islands?
We were there for quite a few days. Yeah, St. Yeah. Thomas. I'd done like 2 days or so in studio, and there was pack up for a remote in St. Thomas. I like this daytime thing under contract. This is fun. And we get down there, and I was have been for a million years, 50 years, I guess, a certified scuba diver. And Ving and I were supposed to do some scuba diving down there in the island. And I get down there, and I had had some back trouble. And all of a sudden, I get this, like somebody speared me in my back. And my left leg started to shudder. And pardon me for saying this, but I projectile vomited. I mean, it was a neurological event. And and my wife, she played the, what was Ellen Wheeler's character's name?
Marley or Vicky?
Marley and Vicky, yes. And she played the double. So I think she came along with, if I recall. But I was in trouble. And I hadn't shot moment one. This was like the first night we were there. Maybe you sit on the plane and kind of throwing my sacroiliac out or something. But... So I had to go to an island doctor, and no worries, man. You know, he handed me, I don't know how many Percocet or something. And so, but my left foot is totally dropped. I have no strength in my left leg at all. So I go out with John Weitzel, the director. We're on the boat. I'm tanked up. I've checked my equipment. Everything's good. And so we're getting ready to go out. And I told the AD, I said, I don't know if I can do this. He said, he looked at Ving and said, Ving, well, are you ready to suit up and do this? And Ving said, do I look like I swim? And that was the end of that. So here's poor Walt with no left leg. I'm swimming. Weitzel's yelling at me. I'm underwater, so I can't hardly hear him. I got no radio or thing, so I can't, you know. And I'm swimming in circles because I have no power in my left leg. He said, no, just swim over there. His feet are getting sunburned. He's so mad with me. Anyway, so that was my first couple of weeks at Another World.
Amazing. That's amazing. Well, later that same year, you were tapped to take over the role of Joe Novak on Ryan's Hope. So tell us how that came about.
You know, I don't know. I don't recall ever trying out. I guess I had to audition for it. I don't honestly recall that. I don't know. I mean, good God knows they had plenty of tape on me by that time. I guess I must have read for it, though, certainly, but I don't remember testing. I got a call from Joe Hardy, you know, to come play. And I did for about 6 months. And then, as I recall, Daniel Pilon, who played Max Dubuchak, my mortal enemy, evidently, decided to retire and go back to Canada and fly his plane. And I don't know that they were, Siobhan was a recast from Mark Helgenberger. As I recall, they weren't quite positive that they'd gotten it right then. Nothing wrong with her, but they weren't going to go. So anyway, they stopped the whole storyline, and you know, I was well into my second 13 weeks. So, and Joe called me in and said, you know, I'm so sorry. You're wonderful. I'm so sorry. You'll be fine. Trust me on this. This is a good thing that we're letting you go on this. So I think there may have been something, because it wasn't 6 months later that children, I think. I'm real bad with time. I'm real bad with time. But it wasn't long after that. So there may have been something afoot then. I don't know, you know. But
well, one thing we know is that you did not audition for the role of Jackson Montgomery.
No.
Us that story.
I don't know that anybody did. I maybe they did. I think they may have used my tape from when I did the screen test for Jeff Martin, maybe, who they called somebody else in the sides, as I recall. So you didn't even know who you were trying to play. I was in the waiting room of an audition for a show called Our Group, which was about a psychiatric therapy group. It was on, I can't remember what it was on now, but it was on, it was on something that ABC owned, that I do recall. Anyway, so I'm sitting there, I figured I'd take the opportunity to check in with my agent, see if anything was going on, see if you're doing anything besides just catching. She used to throw too, you know. And I called her and I said, hey, honey. Her name was Honey Raider. And I said, hey, honey. She said, well, hello, Jackson Montgomery. Now, I have a pretty distinctive voice. And I thought, gee, you know, no, honey, it's Walt. No, you're Jackson Montgomery. I have no idea what you're talking about. She just got a call from Joan Danchenko. They want you to start in 8 weeks. And you're going to be playing Travis Montgomery. And I knew who Travis Montgomery was, of course. You know, you're going to be playing Travis Montgomery's brother, Jackson. I said, oh, man, we look so much alike. Perfect. So I went into this audition. I didn't care at all about this audition, you know. And so I got it, naturally, because I didn't care at all. And I got it. And I was playing, the character's name was Kent. And he was a speechwriter for a Republican senator who was secretly gay. I mean, this was some therapy group. And he was maybe the most normal person in this group, as I recall. And there was a real psychiatrist, may have even created this show, but she was the lead. It was not so good. It was not so good. But it was a three-camera setup. I came in late to the season. I think I came in like on the fourth show. And did probably 8 or 10 of these things. Yes, I'm gay. Finally. And then I had a couple weeks off and I was starting children. So it was perfect. I've been very fortunate. I'm hesitant to say blessed or miracles occurred or angels over me, but I've been very fortunate that you know, the way things have timed out sometimes. Mm-hmm. Very fortunate.
Well, Jack started out.
For which I'm very grateful. Okay, yeah, there we go. Okay,
there
That's
you go.
A full statement.
Yes. Okay. Well, Jack started out as a bad guy you know, one who was never slated to be romantically involved with Erica Kane. And he evolved into a good guy who was nothing if not romantically involved with Erica Kane. So what stands out to you about like the early days of playing Jackson? And when did you notice that the show was starting to, you know, evolve him away from that sort of dark hat persona that he was introduced with?
I don't know that I ever noticed it. The first several years on that show, I was just trying to run to keep up with these people. I guess, yeah, I was trying to, like, I was taking PAC money from Adam and PAC money from Palmer and putting it in Travis's thing to ruin his Senate bid. And yeah, just terrible person. And we found out, I guess, a few years later why, but I think it was and I think Megan McTavish was the head writer at that time, wrote the scene where Travis is somewhere and Erica needs to get to him and Jack is a pilot. Of course. Well, of course, Jack's a pilot. So I take Erica and we go flying to wherever Travis was, I don't recall. And the plane goes down because Jack's not a great pilot. Relatively safely. And we have this adventure, you know, which was essentially it happened one night update, you know, updated, I should say. And we had a lot of fun doing it. And from what I understand, they looked at it and said, well, this is interesting. The chemistry these two have, this is interesting, huh? And I guess they said, well, let's see what happens. I know Larkin, God bless his soul, wasn't very happy with the whole thing. What, you've been here 3 weeks? You know, so no, but Larkin and I were best friends. We went on vacations together and everything else. But are you here 3 weeks and you're rolling around with her? It was a little longer than 3 weeks, but it was she I was rolling around with.
So. Okay, so who did you share dressing rooms with at All My Children over the years?
Larkin Malloy.
Oh, Larkin. Okay.
Larkin. Yeah. Across time. I mean, when I was coming in and doing day player stuff, they might stick me with anybody, you know, but Louis Edmonds, but he may have requested me. And I love me. He told such great stories. So wonderful. I think that was kind of my permanent roommate. We didn't switch off. You were assigned, you know, they put two people in the bunk and that was it. So you didn't float around much.
Well, you told me a story probably 20 years ago.
I may have.
About visiting Louis Edmonds in Martha's Vineyard that I've never forgotten. Do you know what I'm referring to? His gardening skills, if you will.
Yes, but I didn't visit him there. I was sharing a dressing room with
him. Okay, he just told you about it.
Yeah, well, here's the story.
Yes.
He said, tell me, dear boy, do you smoke marijuana? And I said, yes, I do, Louis. And he said, well, here, smoke this, but be sitting when you do it. I said, oh, okay. You know, says it. I want you to know I grew this myself in Mother's Vineyard. And great, thanks, Louis. This is great. And let me tell you what, some of the strongest marijuana I've ever smoked in my life. So that's the story. I guess I can tell that. I don't know.
Well, so then in addition to being a great dressing roommate, he was also a terrific gardener.
Yes.
Special skills.
Listen, if you can get a drug dealer as a dressing roommate, you're in business, all right? In those days.
It's all good. Now, when the show began flirting with the Jack-Erica relationship, and it was in 1989 when they began their affair, I believe, were you at all intimidated to work with Ms. Susan Lucci?
Of course. You know, actually, probably, I probably didn't have sense enough to be intimidated. I mean, because this had been a wild ride. I thought I started Another World in 85, but it's a better story if I don't start that until 86, because it was a pretty big whirlwind. I mean, it was a pretty big, from doing extra, I got 3 days on a party scene, you know, and you start next week, you know. And so, Susan is, first of all, she's a professional. She wants it all to work, because if it works, then we've done our job properly. I think I made her laugh, and I think she liked that. I think I was probably so nervous And that's my default, is to, oh, I'll be a goof, you know. and when I get nervous. So, and that may have, because people are often, I think, in, you know, and rightfully so, in awe of her. And I was too, but probably so much so that I may have done that. And, but we had a nice dynamic, I thought. It was, but always on top of that list was serving the script and doing the best job we knew how to do. You know, I mean, if everything else is rapping, then that's a pretty strong way to be, I think.
Right.
Good place to be.
Well, Jack, I think, holds some kind of record for like the longest running character with the fewest number of wives, right? He was married to Erica, of course, but prior to that, to Laurel. And he had a few other, you know, relationships and lovers. I recall quite a moment with Julia Bars Brooke, for example. Why do you think it was maybe hard for the audience to accept Jack in a long-term relationship with someone not named Erica Kane?
You know, I think I always took that as a compliment and as a horrible criticism, because because if I can't sell you that I am so attracted to this woman, whomever it might be, then I haven't done my job. However, if we did such a good job together that nobody wants to see either one of us with anybody else in this particular medium, that's a big plus. I mean, to be, and I'm not entirely comfortable with this word, but it's just us. To be a super couple, you know, with, I mean, arguably the most successful and famous person to come out of daytime. Well, that doesn't suck. You know, that's a pretty good deal. So it was, you know, the one time that they, it's funny how things work out. They hired an actor to play Laurel, the original Laurel, big, tall, beautiful, blonde. And they didn't think it was working. And they brought in Felicity LaFortune, who I just love. I could look at that little Danish face all day. She is a terrific actor, a voice like a singing voice like a goddess. And it was, but it was too late. You know, it was too late. And so the whole thing of Jack, because that was really Jackson's first storyline, you know, that was kind of about him. And, but it got fumbled, you know, it got fumbled in the kickoff, and we never got it back. And, but boy, I, you know, I've been so lucky. The people I've gotten to play with, you know, Julia Barnes, Susan Lucci, and Felicity LaFortune. And I mean, it's been really good actors, all of them. And, you know, pretty lucky man.
You are indeed. You know, it took Jack and Erica many years to make it to the altar, but when they finally married in 2005, it was a gorgeous ceremony shot on location in Boca Raton, Florida, with Mara in attendance.
That's right. Now,
besides that, of course, what stands out to you about the trip?
I will tell you a story probably nobody knows. What stuck out to me, you know, they wanted me to have my hair sun-kissed, you know, just lightened a little bit here and there. And I think, you know, it looked okay on camera. It looked a little, I don't know, something else off camera, but it looked fine. And I was okay doing it. God bless him, you know. So the girl comes to my house to do it before the wedding, and she forgot to mix stop into it. So she puts this on my hair, and we're chatting, and she said, okay, go rinse it out. And I came back. I looked like Billy Idol. It was white and straight up, man. Holy Christ. And I'm leaving to shoot this in, I don't know, 3 days, 2 days, maybe. I've got to go in later that afternoon and shoot in studio stuff. And I said, okay, so what do we do now? And she said, oh, don't worry. I'll run to my, and I'll come back and we'll dye it back to the color. And I said, well, but the color was several colors. How, you know, anyway. So she did her best, and then they used the temporary stuff to touch it up. And I was so mad. I was so, like, so relaxed and ready to have fun. And then, you know, But hey, things happen. What are you going to do? What are you going to do? So that's probably my biggest memory from checking. Wow. No, I thought it was beautiful. I thought it was beautiful. The stuff that they captured us splashing around in the surf and stuff, the ceremony itself. And now I look at my, some photographer took a picture of my kids. I actually posted for Father's Day, you know, Greenlee and Reggie and Lily and it was I think people, I think they had to do it. I think I've always regretted the fact, because I pitched a few times, you know, go watch a Thin Man movie. Go watch those two. Go watch those two. I mean, you know, instead of marrying us, and here comes the divorce. We were divorced in less than a year, I think. I mean, it was really quick. It was really quick. And I thought, you know, well, why not try? It's, you know, because we both handle comedy. You know, it's exciting. It can be mysterious and yet be fun. I mean, you know, why not? Who else is doing that? Maybe somebody else was. I don't know. But I thought they really missed an opportunity there.
Absolutely. You know, it's sort of like a cliche to say that marriage is the kiss of death on daytime, but it basically literally was.
History bears it out.
Yeah. Sure. And it's a dark period, Walt, so I hate to bring it up, but they actually wrote you off the show when Jack and Erica split up, you know, sent Jack off to Europe. You can hear the anger in my voice all these years later, still undiminished. But on the flip side, did it feel good when the show sort of had to eat crow and say, we made a mistake, will you please come back, Mr. Walt?
You know, I know what happened there. I was fairly vocal about this stuff is terrible. We're, you know, our viewership is already eroding, and this is what you're giving them to keep those that are there. It's terrible. You don't know what you're doing. But that's an opinion. But the problem was, we didn't know how to play this stuff. I mean, they had me making goo-goo eyes through the glass at the prison while Erica's in there. And then 2 weeks after she's out, I'm with her maid that she met in prison. Why?
Right, her cellmate.
Who I don't think I said 10 words to. You know, it really didn't make any. And Susan didn't know how to play the catching of us, because it was like, I'm going to go out and come back in, because I know I didn't just see that, you know, it was just, and I'm sure they had the booms open. And I'm sure we went out on feed. And, you know, when my option came up that July, that was it. But that was kind of fun, though, I got to tell you, because I had just done that summer our first show in my hometown, The Odd Couple. And they fired me, I think, just before we did that. So I grabbed a gig in The Odd Couple at a playhouse down where I had my beach house in Long Beach Island, New Jersey there. So I played Felix in the one in my hometown, and then I got to play Oscar in the other one like 3 months later. That was fun. That was almost worth getting canned for. And then they called and said, you know, we'd like you to come back. And I said, yeah, well, have somebody call me and tell me I was right. You know, somebody over the rank of the janitor, and, you know, just say that I was right. No hard feelings, but that's exactly what happened. Anyway, so I started out there in January of 2010, is that right?
In California?
Yeah, that sounds about right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Okay. I got the phone call, by the way.
I was going to say, did you get the call?
I kind of stopped that story. I'm not even going to say who that was. No, but it was at a level that was satisfactory for me. How's that?
Okay, well done. Perfect. You. I like that. Now, in 2003, Jack was revealed to be Greenlee's biological father. And around that same time frame, he adopted his second child, Reggie, who was played by Michael B. Jordan. So tell us about the relationship you had with him when he was on the show.
Oh, well, I mean, here's a young man that, as far as I'm concerned, deserves everything that he's gotten. Everything. And he could be a total ass now. I have no idea. It's been a couple of years since I've talked to him. But he deserves it all. I mean, I lived in Jersey City, and he lived in Newark. And so his mom would take him to the donut shop outside the Holland Tunnel. I'd pick him up there and we'd go to work together on days that we were working together. And then I'd take him home afterwards. And we were in the blackout together where I said, drive the car, I'm gonna direct this traffic going into the Lincoln Tunnel. Well, we got in there pretty quick actually, but he was wonderful. And I remember him being so hurt and sad when they let him go. And I remember thinking, this is the best thing that could ever happen to you. Best thing. And then one long afterwards, Fruitvale Station, you know, which was his kicking the door open thing. And one of the first things he did was got his mom out there, you know, out in Los Angeles. And I think that's so smart. You know, 17, 18 year old kid go out there and start to hit, gee whiz, you know, who knows? But so super smart. I'm super proud of him. You know, I mean, he's my boy for Pete's sake. Of course, I'm proud of him.
Of course. I just loved him, loved his mom. I have a lot of fond memories of that era. All right. So all my children went off the air in 2011, as we all know and we all lament. So I'm obviously giving quite the Cliff's Notes version here, because we want to dig into your stint on GH. But after the show went off the air, you returned to your roots. You moved home for a while. You rekindled the theater that you had been involved in. And also, you went ahead and got married again. So we want to hear a little bit about your love story with Mrs. Willie.
I hung around Los Angeles for a couple of years and nothing was happening for me. And, you know, 25 years on a daytime show means nothing. I mean, I go into auditions and there were, you know, actors we all know, they've done, you know, 10 films. I'm sitting there, well, this isn't going to happen today. So, you know, but I had just finished Wild Bill, my one man show about Wild Bill Hickok. So I was immediately out on the road with that. And then in 2014, I went back, as you say, to my hometown, and I was there until 2018. And on my birthday in 2014, I was doing Zany's Comedy Club in Nashville. And in walks this beautiful, raven-haired, black Irish-looking girl, sits down at a table right in front by herself at a four-top. So I figure there have to be other people coming, you know. But no, she's there for the pre-show meet and greet. She's there for the show. She's giving me the goo-goo eyes. You know, I did my whole show to her. I was very unprofessional. and it was my birthday. Did I mention that? It was my birthday. So happy birthday to me. And we've been together since. She's a singer-songwriter here in town, has opened for Dolly, has opened for Loretta, has opened for, and she's an amazingly talented woman, amazingly talented.
Tell Stephanie what her surname was.
Oh, yes. I married Sarah Kane. Yes. Spelled differently, though. K-A-I-N-E, spelled differently, but yes.
That's very me.
Hurricane. Not creepy at all, huh?
Not at all. Well, let's get to General Hospital. So you are airing as we speak.
But look where I am. I'm with you.
And we couldn't be more appreciative. So how did you find out that GH was interested in having you come play in their sandbox a bit as Jackson?
Michael Knight called me. And he said, you know, how are you? I said, well, good, Michael. I haven't talked to you in quite a while. I'm good. Hey, listen, Frank Valentini just stopped me in the hall, who, for folks that don't know, is the executive producer of General Hospital. And he said, so, Walt Willie, what kind of a guy is he, you know? And I said, what did you say, Michael? He said, oh, I said, you were a great guy. So I sent him a check out, make sure he got paid. And, a couple days later, maybe the same day, maybe, I don't know. As I say, my time thing is shot. Mark Teschner called and explained what they had in mind. And I said, well, that sounds like fun. Little did I know that, you know, the thing about riding a bicycle, you never forget how, even though you haven't ridden one for long. I felt like I had not only not been on a bicycle in 12 years, but I was immediately riding in the Tour de France. I mean, this was paddles to them. But I said, yeah, no, that sounds good. That sounds fine. Let's do that. So that's how it happened. And I immediately like, so when will you be getting those scripts to me soon, right? I mean, you're getting the scripts to me soon? Well, we haven't fixed the day and time yet. Okay, but the scripts are written, right? So you could send those if you wanted. I hadn't done anything like that in a long time, you know. Learning and remembering a 60-page monologue when you've written it yourself is not near as difficult as it sounds, you know. But, you know, I did 3 shows in 2 days. I mean, it was crazy. It was crazy. Crazy.
That's nuts. It is absolutely nuts. Mr. Michael E. Knight was your gracious host while you were in California.
He was indeed.
Flunking with him like.
He was Felix and I was Oscar. I'm so glad I set that up earlier. No, Michael is, I love this man. He's one of the kindest, most generous, and incredibly hospitable people you could have as a friend. I mean, I couldn't do anything. My first day that I had a 9 o'clock wardrobe call, I didn't hit set till 4:30. I don't think I was home till 9:30 or so. And Michael had dinner waiting for me.
I love that.
I know. So sweet. What a great guy. What a great guy.
Yes. Now you said the set was very welcoming. You know, how would you generally describe your days, you know, there in General Hospital?
Well, in a haze. I mean, you know, I so wanted to do well, and I had so many things that I wanted to do. And, you know, they moved pretty good there. And the last time I did this, you could say, so hang on, before we start, can I just get 10 seconds to look at this? And I have one more question. Could you ask the booth? There's none of that. There's none of that, you know. No, nope, question time was last hour. Let's go. And, you know, and but it's something that I could easily get used to again, but having not done it in a while, it was a big difference.
So the setup for Jackson's appearance with the Port Charles community is, I think, very delicious because you've got Felicia and Lucy investigating why Martin is getting these payments from Pine Valley. And they come knocking on Jack's office door, which means that you got to intersect with the lovely and talented Christina Wagner and Lynn Herring. And we want to hear all about what that was like.
Again, I just have to say they were so welcoming and sweet and available. And it was just, it was a lot of fun. I guess I worked more with Lynn. I worked with both of them, but I guess I worked more with Lynn because we, you know, we, just the way the scenes played out. But yeah, they're very nice. Lynn Herring is a lot of fun. She's very slinky. She's very, very slinky. Very slinky. It was fun. It was a lot of fun.
She said that you were sparkly, by the way.
What's that?
She said that you were sparkly.
I was sparkly? Well,
Slinky and Sparkly. We have new nicknames for you both.
Yes.
She gets a check too. So,
well, when the news broke of your General Hospital visit, it got a huge response from fans. So, what did it mean to you to know that you and Jackson are still very much near and dear to the hearts of the daytime audience?
Well, that's wonderful to hear. I mean, I've said it a million times. I'll say it again. The fans, fans of daytime are the best fans of all. I don't care what anybody says. I mean, they have loved me and supported me and everything I've done for 30 years. And I, especially these days, to have people that are who honestly give you that kind of love and that kind of care and that kind of interest, it's a gift like crazy. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, next week fans can enjoy the exciting conclusion your time on General Hospital. I am holding out hope that it will be the first of many visits. It really is just such a joy to have you back in our world for a little bit. And
nice to say that. Thank you. It's good to be back. I will have to run to keep up, I'm sure, at this point, but it's good to be back. It's a lot of fun.
Well, can you put into words how your life changed from when you got that call, you know, low those many years ago, 1987, to play Jack, and what your years in Pine Valley mean to you now when you look back on them?
You know, that's a lot of ground to cover there. I mean, for an actor to be able to go to the ballpark every day and get paid for it is a pretty good deal. I love to act. and or at least I did in those days. I loved that. And to be able to do a play a day like that, to, you know, part be, you know, maybe you do 140 of the 260 shows that year. I mean, come on. Where do you get that kind of, you know, to stretch out every day? It also gave me incredible opportunities to do other things. You know, I started doing stand up in 90, 91, I guess. And I did a gig last February. I mean, it's, you know, I'm still doing it. And I never would have, you know, I started off as a headliner, which was ridiculous, but the strength of the show allowed me to do that, you know. And I was terrible at first. Oh, it was terrible. But I also think, you know, and I hosted so many things. I got to meet so many people and see parts of the world I would never have seen probably. And I don't know. It was just, interestingly enough, as wonderful as it was, and it was, I don't miss it. And that to me is a relief. After doing something like that for so long, I thought, oh my God, what am I, one of these people that just can't put the grease paint away? How miserable am I going to be? But I wasn't. And I was so grateful for that, because then it really kept though that time as this wonderful golden time in and of itself, not the good old days, you know, because I'm having good nowadays, you know. So that kept it even more golden to me. But the people I met, the opportunities given, the, you know, it's pretty good money, you know, I mean, there's a million reasons to be so thankful for that.
Yeah. Well, we are thankful to have you back. We are thankful you shared all your stories today, and we hope this is the first of many reasons to have to talk to you soon.
Yes.
Yes, yes. And we can keep it under a sealed indictment. Would be okay with me if we could. That'd be good. All right. Ladies, yeah. Thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you to Walt Willey for being our guest. If you like this podcast, please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Be sure to pick up a new issue on sale now and come back next week for another podcast.